Let it rip.
We are already on. So
welcome to Congress Two Beers In. It's been a while. It's middle of July. We have passed the one big beautiful bill or one big ugly mess, whatever your partisan preferences want to call it. I'm here. I'm Matt Glassman, senior fellow GAI. I'm here with my colleague Josh Shooter. How you doing, Josh?
I'm drinking coffee at the moment.
Yeah.
That's kind of where I am. It's Congress Two Beers In, but I've got a coffee. It's
fine.
I'm
amped up on a bunch of Coke Zeros and ready to roll. Okay, right, so I think go ahead.
Where are we going on this?
One big beautiful bill. I think there's a lot of ways to talk about this. We're going to want to get into. I think one reset I like is, you know, I think Liam Donovan, I thought, had a really good take on this bill, just at a policy level. And that is, this bill is like a bunch of different things, and it feels like a lot, but you can group it pretty systematically. And, you know, the most interesting part of this bill to me is that the biggest piece of this thing, this big piece of policy, right? The biggest piece of it is something no one's going to notice, because the biggest piece of this is just a massive tax extender package that just maintains the status quo. And that's a weird thing to say. Like, this is the sort of central nature of this policy is a status quo policy of extending something that was going to expire. And that is sort of most of the tax provisions for individuals and businesses and a whole bunch of other stuff and little stuff. And then sort of glommed on top of that is a around the margins, little tax changes that people might see. No tax on tips, like Trump says, a bigger exemption for seniors, which is sort of the equivalent of no tax on Social Security, and no tax on overtime, and a little expansion of child tax credit. But the bulk of the center of this law, right, is something no one's going to notice, but also the same thing is going to have huge fiscal implications for the country. And so that's a weird thing. And then the other bucket you can put this in is sort of significant cuts to Medicaid, right, and then repeal of a fair number of energy policy things from the Biden administration. And then something that's interesting to me and you, I think, but maybe less to other people, is a heck of a lot of what I would normally call discretionary appropriations going to defense and to Homeland Security and specifically to ICE. Yeah. And so that's sort of from a policy view, right? Like, this is a ton of stuff in here, and there's little provisions everywhere that people can talk about for their specific thing. Those are the buckets I see this in as a piece of policy making. And of course, there's lots to get into procedurally, sort of long-term, sort of how this looks from a budgetary perspective, the Budget Act and all that. But what's your main takeaway? Because that was one of my main takeaways. Just think about this thing as a set of policies that are going to affect people and that politicians are going to have to defend in the next election. And at the core of it is a sort of status quo thing with then a lot of big pieces around the edge, the Medicaid changes, the energy policy changes, the money for defense and ICE. But what's your first cut takeaway on it?
I sort of have a hard time summarizing it just because it's like it's so much stuff. There's like that old saying, you know, the sausage making part of the legislative process, and this has like every single component you could possibly want. I mean, it's got grabs for certain people, it's got like specific cutouts for carve outs for certain members. I mean, you can see how everybody was kind of working to like get the yes on this and like what it required. And like that's interesting. One thing I do want to come back to later, I don't want to talk about it right now because I think it's important, it's like getting the discretionary money into reconciliation bills, right? That's it's got some massive implications that I want to talk about a little bit later. But from the just like the political side of it, it's really interesting to me that like one, like this blows up the deficit, right? And it's not uncommon, but it is something that like members of Congress are going to have to defend, right? And it blows up the deficit to essentially like keep things the way they are, right? Are people going to notice this? Is this going to be an overall net positive? I think a lot of members, I mean, I was reading a Semaphore piece this morning where there's several senators who are talking about like repealing parts of it. It's like it was passed a week ago, right? It was passed a week ago and they're like, you know, got Jim Justice mentioning, he's the guy, Josh Hawley saying, like, yeah, we're gonna have to look at this and see if we're gonna have to keep some of this or kick some of this out. I mean, it's just sort of, it's gonna be very interesting to watch them defend this because I think they're already feeling like they're on the back foot on this sort of thing. And one of the reasons that I think that that's probably true is, you know, we think of the Republican Party as sort of like the MAGA populist wing versus like the kind of like old guard conservative establishment, or at least the old, like the conservative establishment as it is, like, you know, lower taxes, small government, et cetera, et cetera. cetera. And those like two coalitions are still here. We don't typically think of them in that way, but like this has got all the hallmarks of like the establishment conservative wing of the party, and very few of the hallmarks that you find in like kind of like a populist MAGA wing of the party. And so we're still seeing that tension, right? I mean, that's something that we saw in Trump 1.0 far more aggressively, with like the Jeff Flakes and the Bob Corkers and the people who were like willing to just stand up against the president. You don't see that as much today, right? You're seeing a lot of members who are like shying away. I mean, we just saw an appropriations bill yesterday kind of blow up, because there was one provision that like could potentially anger the president or upset the president, and like Republicans just basically shied away from the entire thing, and it blew up the bill, right? So you see a lot more sort of like political fear of the president, because he does seem to have like a much tighter grip of the Republican Party. But this congressional majority in the House and in the Senate still has all the hallmarks of that kind of like old traditional conservative
It is,
ideology.
that's a really interesting point to me, because I do think that there is a real and certainly a rhetorical populism to a lot of Republicans now that you wouldn't have found 20 years ago. And certainly people like Hawley, it comes front and center. And I think, and for whatever reason that is, constituents, politics, whatever, personal preference, he does seem to want to walk the walk a little more. But the centrality of this bill, you could imagine this piece of legislation sort of like emanating from a Romney presidency, right? It has some tinges around the edges of things Romney would never go for. Romney would not be sort of like the no tax on tips guy, right? And that sort of stuff that was pasted on from the White House. But the center of this bill is essentially sort of keeping taxes low and sort of starting to find a way to offset that by reducing sort of distributive services from the government on the healthcare side. And like at the center of that is like sort of traditional establishment Republican politics. So I agree with you that whatever sort of populist transformation we're seeing in the Republican Party hasn't quite, become sort of the central piece of the policymaking process for them. It still reflects sort of traditional business interests and traditional sort of conservative interests, as we knew them in the 90s and 2000s, not sort of any other type of conservative, but that sort of Paul Ryan and Mitt Romney probably found things a lot to like about this bill. And I think that's important to remember.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to watch like guys like Tom Tillis. I mean, who came up very much in like the kind of like Tea Party wave-ish. I mean, he wasn't elected in 2010, but he's elected in that kind of like vein when he first came up, and he was elected in, for the first time, I think it was 2014, that he won. And he was very much a conservative Republican. I mean, he's a really conservative guy when he was in the House. And or was he was in the House, right? I'm getting him, for some reason I picture him and like Ryan Zinke's face pops in my head, and like I get him mixed up. But in anyway, he was like a very conservative guy, and like he walked away from this, and he was one of those guys who was kind of a little bit more MAGA friendly. I mean, obviously he's facing like a really tough re-election in North Carolina, and North Carolina may be shifting in a significant way coming up too, as large as well as other portions of the South, right? Georgia, for example.
And I do think that, as always, how you sell this bill is going to be sort of very important in the election, because there are a lot of things that Republicans are going to want to go out and talk about, mainly sort of tax cuts in this bill. And there's a lot of things that Democrats are going to want to go talk about, mainly Medicaid cuts. And those things are sort of things that impinge across various districts and states. One interesting geography of this bill that came to my mind was thinking through things like the SALT guys in the House, which is basically sort of blue state Republicans in moderate or wealthy districts who have high property taxes. That doesn't exist in the Senate, right? All the sort of there's no blue state really there's no wealthy blue state Republicans in the Senate. They just don't exist. And so you can see sort of how sort of those fringe issues map across the House and Senate. The other thing I think that's interesting about this bill is that it is both a bill that you can call a House product. Like this bill was developed and sort of negotiated, and they went the House direction on this, and yet they still got jammed by the Senate on some of the particulars at the end. But I do think.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that was interesting to me is that the Senate made it a little more conservative, right? I mean, like they had more cuts after the Senate came through, which was sort of
Yes.
it was a surprising turnaround. And then like to watch it come back to the House and then watch them eat it, I was a little bit surprised, I'll be honest with you. I thought some of the political jockeying over in the House side, like, oh, this is a like I mean, there were some strong words when they were describing the Senate product, right? Somebody said it was morally bankrupt and fiscally irresponsible, and then they turned around and voted for it, and you're like, whoa, 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 right? Like,
They got
that's a
jammed against the
whiplash.
deadline. But I think that does obscure, and the Senate made some changes to this that the House had to eat. There's no doubt about this. But this thing was the way the House wanted to do this, not the way the Senate wanted to do this. And I think that reflects sort of the longer, almost like a year-long process in the House to build this bill and do it in one big bill and to start with the priorities of the House and have the House do sort of the legwork with the interest groups. And one thing that came to mind is that, the Senate's traditional way of jamming the House is that they need to get sort of that 60-vote compromise. And once they put that in place, they just say to the House, they say, well, there's nothing we can do. This is the deal. You have to take it or leave it, find a way to leave it. That's not available on reconciliation. And on reconciliation, when you only need 50 votes, then the House is on a much more even playing field with the Senate. And so, for the Senate to jam their changes in here, they had to rely on this sort of artificial deadline. Artificial deadlines, people are like, why does that work? Well, one reason is if you blow past that deadline and reopen anything, you sort of reopen everything. And I think for a lot of people, a lot of Republicans, this bill met 92% of what they wanted out of it, or 86% of wanted out of it. But they knew that any changes or blowing past the artificial deadline all of a sudden unleashes the idea that everybody gets another crack at this. And so, like, Murkowski was explicitly saying that. It sounded stupid when she said it, like, I hope I get another chance at this. But, like, that was basically all you need to hear in the House to be like, well, we better pass this now, or this thing's going back into full negotiation in both chambers. And so I think their deadline sort of worked in that sense. It was completely artificial. There was no reason this had to be done by July 4th. The debt limit wasn't coming to issue or anything like that. But I think they were worried about it falling back apart into squabbling among various groups. And the key moment in this, I think, turns out to be getting the budget resolution through the House, and getting that House product rolling.
Well, it's also like that old axiom, right? Where, the chamber with a narrower margin tends to have more leverage. And that was that's certainly the case in the House, right? I mean, the Senate, like, it's weird. It's 53-47. Like, it's pretty thin margin. But, like, in the House, like, you've got a 51-49 margin. I mean, it's for, percentage wise. It's, I mean, you can only lose, like, so many votes. And I think
And
that,
a couple of them are going right out of the gate, right? And
yeah.
yeah, so I was interested to see that. The other thing that obviously interests me here, from the deficit side, is sort of this reworking of reconciliation. And there's obviously procedural things to talk about, but the switch to sort of current policy baseline instead of current law. And I think
Oh, we're
this is
going here now. Where this is where you want to go? You want to go down here? It's like
I do. It's super important. And
it's crazy important.
there's big fights over this, but basically the idea is, how are you going to score these bills? And one way to score them is to score them on current law.
Which is
So
what
that means,
CBO and other like scorekeepers are often mandated to do by law. Like
right. So
statutorily,
you score by
CBO
current
has to
law.
look at the entire law. So like when it's looking at these tax cuts from Trump 1.0, it has to phase in like and understand like these are phased out over the next 4 years or whatever they are. So you're actually going to get increased revenue. And that's what they're all the scoring is based on. That's why you see like these massive things of like, oh, it costs like $3 trillion or $2 trillion or what it is because like they've got that into the baseline. Like revenues were supposed to go up, the government was supposed to recoup more money. And so they're thinking about it and they're scoring it in those terms.
Philosophically, like, scoring laws, like, if you're going to say, well, this is a 2-year law, and then after 2 years, the taxes will go back up and we'll raise more revenue, that's reasonable. Scoring it the other way is reasonable too. We just score things based on current policy, and you don't get to make savings in the future until you actually raise taxes. I think either of those are fine as long as you're consistent. The problem here is that the Republicans have devised a killer way to make everything look rosy but cheap, which is to say, when you're making things temporary, you use current law so that it looks like revenues go up in the future. And then when it's time to extend those, you say it's current policy so that actually extending them doesn't cost anything. And, like, that's a disaster from
So
a budgeting point of
so
view,
you're
any
essentially
sort of
just not
statistics.
taking as you're score quote unquote scoring on the current policy baseline, you're just not accounting for the revenue increases and that's under the law, right? You're just kind of pretending those don't exist and you're going off the current baseline.
And so, like, the real sin here in my mind was back in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act in 2017, which said these tax cuts are only going to last for X number of years, and they were about to expire now. And then after that, the reason this won't cost so much in 2017 is that revenues are going to go up in the out year in 2026, and we'll make that up. The problem is, everyone sort of knows that the idea is to make this stuff permanent. And now we come to make it permanent and we say, well, we don't have to score those out years as losing revenue because all we're doing is extending what we have now. And, like, I'm actually a fan of current policy baseline because it gets rid of this temporary trick. I wish everything was scored on current policy and you couldn't say, well, we'll make savings because taxes are going to automatically raise in a decade. To me, that's the bigger lie. And so this bill is sort of the heart of the contradiction here because the extended Trump tax cuts now are scored on current policy baseline, so it doesn't cost anything to extend those, right? That missing revenue that you would have gotten if they expired, you don't get. But other pieces of this are now temporary and are scored on current law. So they're saying we are going to get revenue when the taxes on tips expire, when the tax on when the senior deduction expires, when the tax on overtime expires. So it's a nightmare and an absolute deficit hole. Now, look, I don't want to pretend the Democrats are a whole lot better on this. I think the Republicans have basically been now 40 years down the road, certainly since Reagan, on wanting to cut taxes, but not really cut spending, just shift spending to their priorities. And the Democrats, I think, under Clinton and Obama, could arguably incredibly say they were interested in deficits and fiscal responsibility. Since Biden, I think they're sort of off the chain on that too. So I don't see a party in Washington that has a real gut to fix this, but we've never had a huge appetite from voters for like deficits, right? Like that people want low taxes and lots of spending. Like that's sort of the irrationality of it. The problem is like this actually may be a policy problem coming pretty soon, especially at these interest rates. We're spending, you know, what, $1 trillion a year now in interest payments or something close to that. That's more than we're spending on defense. And like that's a real that's like a real hole of money and crowding out of just interest payments that we're making on this stuff. And I don't have much hope that any of that is going to get solved. And it does worry me.
I
Yeah,
think
go
it
ahead.
does create more of a crisis point, right? You just pointed it out, right? Interest payments are going to get astronomically high. This is going to accelerate that, like by a lot, to be frank, right? And how the markets react to this, and how much they're willing to pay for our bonds and service our debt, et cetera, it could get much worse, right, in the near future. And it could create like kind of a flashpoint, because in the not too distant future, we may be looking at interest payments that sort of like dwarf the actual size of all discretionary spending, right? In other words, like all money that we spend to fund every agency in the federal government could be dwarfed by just the interest payment that we make that year, right?
And we're getting to the point where, you know, the old sort of saw was that if you want to adjust the deficit, you have to either raise taxes, right? You have to cut Social Security or Medicare, right? Or you have to attack defense. It's not clear attacking defense would help you that much now. They're so big a deficit that you are really up a creek. And I think everybody has, they tell themselves these myths that you got the Trumpists telling themselves that tariffs are going to fill in the revenue. And that is just a complete joke. And then you
It's
got
like
a
what the
lot of
tariffs are bringing in, like what, 250 billion a year right now, and that's like at, and a deficit of 1.5, that's 1.5 trillion. That's like that's not helping, right? It's
No,
not,
it's not. And
it's
that's
never
if you
going to make
maintain
up for it.
these tariffs forever going forward. And on the other end of the spectrum, it's there's just not enough billionaires to tax to that you know sort of progressive vision of just doing this off taxing the rich is going to work. There's not a lot of solutions besides massive cuts to spending and spending no one wants to cut or significant broad-based tax increases across sort of the middle class. And that's really sort of a lot of third rails there to hit. And I don't see any of that coming anytime soon. You can always pray that you'll supercharge the economy the way we did in the late 90s and sort of do some growing out of it. But people forget that that growing out of it was combined with Clinton raising taxes and them holding down spending pretty good in his second term.
So when those economic increases did come, the government actually recouped more revenue, right? I mean, a larger chunk of revenue. I mean, it's real simple, right? You got to cut spending and raise taxes if you're going to do this. You can't do it with like, and the problem is we have one party who said like no to tax increases and one party that said no to spending cuts, and they just kind of like veto each other out, right? And it's created a situation where there's going to be a real inflection point in the
And
not too distant future.
there's no way. I mean, people out there will talk themselves into anything. The idea that you can do this by cutting foreign aid, right? Like, that's it. USAID is gone, right? It's not going to make it. It's not even going to reduce spending this year. And so like you can look around for things people hate, but there's almost nothing everybody hates. And cutting little things like foreign aid or even cutting significant things like, you know, even means testing Medicare against work requirements doesn't get you that much revenue. Excuse me, Medicaid. And so that's a problem. What else, you know,
Well, I want to talk about we talked about
Go
like the
ahead.
actual process, this like current policy versus whatnot. Like, I want to talk about how Republicans actually did this because it has massive institutional implications for the Senate. Sarah Benda had her fantastic piece, a fantastic blog piece
Oh,
on this in
yeah.
Good Authority. She talked about this because the way the Republicans did this, normally when you have a when you have a bill, a reconciliation bill in the Senate, that goes through a process where the parliamentarian hears arguments from the majority and the minority about what can be included in that reconciliation bill, because there are a lot of restrictions on what can be included. Things like, there can't be any changes to revenue in out years. There can't be any changes to Social Security. There can't be merely incidental fiscal changes. There can't be, if a policy doesn't have any like direct spending or revenues in it, it can't be included, right? All of these are like really important restrictions on what can be included in a reconciliation bill that makes the policy a budget bill, right? It can't be just kind of like frivolous, like every pie in the sky policy stuff. What Republicans did here is that they basically went around the parliamentarian, right? The parliamentarian advises how she would rule if a point of order was made on a certain provision of the bill. And then theoretically, the chair of the Senate listens to that advice and then rules based on that advice. In this case, Republicans use the authority that they have is that the Budget Act says that the budget chair, the budget chairman decides and the budget committee decides whether or not something violates the Budget Act or not. And in this case, they went down to the Senate floor, said that the budget committee ruled that the current policy baseline standard through which they did this was the proper standard and there was no point of order against it. And what this allowed them to do is basically pass this bill under the current policy baseline, the thing that Matt and I were just talking about, and create out year deficits, right? So deficits in year 11, 12, 13, 14, 15 that are going to be much bigger won't be counted as deficits because it's a current policy and not a law based on current law. And so they're getting around the Burt rule, right? This is really just a way for them to get around the Burt rule. They raised a point of order, they sustained the chair. Sorry, they raised the point of order with the expectation that the chair was going to rule against it, right? And
They
then
got
they sustained the chair.
a friendly ruling in the chair.
Right. I mean, John Thune said, I'm going to raise a point of order and I expect the chair to have this ruling that point makes my point of order out of order. Right. And it was like, it's kind of a backwards way of doing it, but it's using the chair to get around legal requirements as we understand them today. This does have massive implications because what Republicans have done is basically like it's a nuclear event, right? You've created a set of policy that was previously not allowed under reconciliation, a non-filibusterable vehicle. To now be stuck in there, right? And it creates all sorts of potential expansion of spending, expansion of more revenue cuts, not the other way around. Because these out year deficits, that was a way to meant to way to constrain what was in these bills. You got to keep in mind when this policy was put in place in 1974, it was meant to constrain spending. It was meant to reduce deficits and kind of keep a handle on mandatory spending and revenues, right? This ruling really does kind of like open the door for the opposite, and it's got massive implications because again, if a majority is just going to ignore what the legal restrictions, then we really do have like sort of a Wild West situation in the Senate, sort of like what we have in the House, where they're just ignoring the rules and the laws that are supposed to bind these processes.
Yeah, I mean, I think that like what we're seeing here is just the extension of more and more ways of doing majoritarian lawmaking via reconciliation in the Senate. And I agree with you, this is a huge change. But the other way to see this is just an expansion of a long-term trend here. Two other pieces of this are one you brought up, which is that reconciliation as sort of like envisioned in 1974 is so far afield from where we are now. But one of the things that was interesting was
Yeah,
that, well,
Robert Byrd's rolling over in his bird grave right now.
yeah, but the idea of reconciliation is, on its face, is that you're going to use this to shrink the deficit. This is going to be an easy way to raise taxes or cut spending to get the budget in line. And sort of the uses in the 21st century of both parties to write reconciliation instructions that expand the deficit is sort of making a mockery of sort of the original intention law. So that's one sort of way
Oh,
that this process is.
that's absolutely right. Like, I mean, the thing is, like, the reason they're doing this is because minorities are not allowing majorities to govern. Like, there's aren't anymore, right? This started happening around the 2000s, where you start to see reconciliation bills expanding the debt, expanding deficits, and it's because all of a sudden filibusters became ubiquitous, and we had an upper chamber that was no longer a majority chamber. It was a 60-vote Senate. It's a super majority institution, really functionally, around the early 2000s.
And this is the release valve on that, right? Is that more and more stuff is being put into the reconciliation process so that it can be done by majorities. One is sort of the expansion of deficit, so the ability to spend money at least temporarily that raise the deficit or cut taxes. And the second thing, which is began sort of tender hooks in ARPA and then the IRA, and now is just full blown in there, is putting what is discretionary appropriations in all other senses into these
We're
bills.
not going there yet. We're still not there, Matt. You keep trying to wade into appropriations.
Man,
Just
but
stop
I
that.
mean,
Stop it.
the point is, if you think the filibuster is going to survive in the Senate, it may survive in the sense that you're going to be required to get 60 votes to end debate on the legislative calendar items, and just anything that can't get 60 votes that a party really wants to do is going to end up in the reconciliation process. It's sort of creating almost a third calendar in the Senate, the executive calendar, the legislative calendar, and the reconciliation calendar. I mean, I know it's not actually technically creating a calendar, but we're seeing basically everything being routed this way as sort of the easiest way to avoid actually having to undo the filibuster on the legislative calendar. And I just don't see any way around reading it that way, is that I don't see any party sort of pulling back from this. This is at least the third reconciliation bill in a row, and probably all of the ones in the 21st century that have had this pressure on them to sort of do things that we otherwise couldn't do in the Senate.
I want to put some context around this because I think a lot of people are sort of thinking like, well, hasn't the Senate always been this way? And the answer is no, it has not always been this way. There was a time where like senators who were in the minority would just allow the majority to govern, right? They would allow bills to pass with 56 votes. They would allow bills to pass with 61 votes, right? I mean, but today, even bills with massive, massive bipartisan support that are going to pass with 80, 90 votes, they still get filibustered. And when you filibuster a vehicle, even if it's got 90 votes in support, when 10 senators are like, well, we're going to filibuster, what that requires is 2 weeks of legislative time to process the fil like the cloture process, right? To cut off debate on that particular piece of legislation. And that's just too much time, right? The Senate is like, you know, people talk to me about or ask me like, what's wrong with Congress? I'm like, well, which chamber are you talking about, right? I mean, the House is dysfunctional, but it's dysfunctional not because of the House. It's a majority body. It just sort of like does what the majority wants to do. It's a bit dysfunctional because the majority doesn't have a majority, right? They don't have a majority of votes on a lot of stuff. And so like, it's really hard for them to act like a majority because they don't have a majority. The Senate's a totally broken institution, on the other hand, right? Senators are abusing the filibuster. And because they're doing that, you're creating this process where majorities are incentivized to go through these expedited procedures because it's the only way they can actually get things done, right? And so they're sticking appropriations bills in there now, right? I mean, they're not appropriations bills, but they're appropriation spending. They're sticking all their partisan priorities because simply the minority party won't let up. They won't relent. It's really an abuse of power. And when we see this, like throughout congressional history, when you see minorities abuse their power, the majority clamps down, right? And I want to know when the majority is just going to grow up like and act like a courageous majority and just get rid of the damn thing, right? The filibuster's stupid, right? Why do we have it still? It's a bad institution at this point.
I mean, the amount of sort of explainers I would have to do would be washed away pretty quickly if we never had to do another reconciliation bill again
I know.
in the Senate. It's Molly Reynolds, political scientist at Brookings, has a wonderful book called Exceptions to the Rule, which is about how the Senate has carved out lots of ways this. And the book is probably, I don't know, 15, 20 years old at this point, but like it really is sort of a wonderful sort of foreshadowing of even more of what Molly was talking about. Molly was talking about, 15 years ago, about how much the Senate had started to create ways around the filibuster, and now it just seems to be on steroids. And I think at the root of this is another thing, which is that unified government in the modern age is going to be an exercise in a party putting in place its party program. And once they decide what that party program is, it is not going to be a situation where if they have 218 votes in the House and 50 votes in the Senate, that they are going to allow sort of rules to stand in the way of the centerpieces of those programs. And that might be a good thing, right? Like, this is a reason we have sort of big elections and parties win unified governments. Maybe they should be allowed to do their program, but it is certainly running up head right into the wall of the current structure of the United States Senate for sure.
Yeah. It's, I mean, and it's depressing to see, because it's the Senate that I teach, or the Senate that I used to teach, right, is very much going away. On the other hand, like, it's also a situation that can't continue, right? We can't continue to have a Senate this dysfunctional, because it really is bogging down a lot of things, right? I mean, it's this breakdown in the Senate, the inability to process things by majority vote. It's at the root of, like, the breakdown in the authorization process. It's at the root of the breakdown in the appropriations process. It's at the heart of these omnibus legislative vehicles that we see. I mean, like, really, the problems that we see with Congress, like, without, like, deliberating issues and then passing policy, really is because we have an institution that just blocks everything.
That's right. And I think the omnibus stuff is really important, because if you can imagine a Senate that just allowed majority votes, it would still be tough to get stuff. I mean, the Senate is no easy place to legislate,
We saw
but
that last week, right?
you can imagine this reconciliation bill actually being a bunch of different policies, being people working on a tax policy, people working on energy policy, people working on defense and border security policies. And the need to stuff this all into singular reconciliation bills creates this sort of bargaining environment that both sort of shuts out low-level policymaking, and also raises the stakes for voting against it. That jams a lot of members who might want nuanced policy and all these things. And you think it was hard to put this bill together, right? An actual sort of functional Senate would have to work through even more difficulty, but that, in my mind, would be a good thing,
Right.
where we aren't sort of having people take up-down votes on both tax cuts, energy policy, Medicaid cuts, defense spending, and border security spending, right? Those to me are very distinctive issues where I think a lot of people have five different positions on them.
They deserve separate debates, right? They deserve separate debates, and separate majorities should be able to coalesce behind these sorts of things, right? Different majorities, different bipartisan coalitions, like, whatever it is, they should be allowed to do that. And one of the frustrating things to watch is, like, these, like, mega omnibuses at the end, when we have this big spending bill, right? And we've got the 12 appropriations bills stuck into this thing, and then you have, like, 36 other bills from committees that just have been bottled up in the Senate, right? It's like, oh, here's one from natural resources, here's one from energy and commerce, here's one from judiciary. And the reason that they can't get them through, like, in a normal, just kind of, like, one-off process, where, like, these separate bills which have bipartisan support, they can't get through the Senate because it's been in filibustered, right? It's just, it deserves a real debate. And I do believe that the filibuster has just gotten out of control, but it would be nice to see less omnibus stuff. And speaking of omnibus, appropriations committees are becoming less relevant as we speak. It's amazing to watch the appropriations committees sort of, like, winnow away. If there was one committee that I thought was going to retain power over its jurisdiction, it was appropriations. But what we've seen, and what Matt's been talking about, and what I've been putting off so far in this podcast, is that a lot of really discretionary funds are increasingly being put in reconciliation bills. And that's not the way it's normally been. Reconciliation was not seen as a vehicle to pass normal appropriations, annual appropriations bills. It was typically viewed just to handle direct spending and revenues, right? Direct spending is typically, like, that formulaic spending that you're thinking about: food stamps, Medicare, Medicaid,
Security.
crop subsidies, like, all of these things that, like, it's just a formula. You qualify under this formula, you get a certain benefit, right? And that's what it was supposed to deal with. But there's nothing in the law that says you can't do appropriations, right, in this way. And so they found a way to code these basically discretionary spending funds as direct spending, right? So it's not appropriations in a
Why
way.
are we even doing that, right? I mean, you just look at the law. It's just like, literally, here's $50 billion for 5 years for missiles or whatever. Like, it looks like a annual appropriations act. And the weird part to me is, like, at the detail level, like, you get nothing. Like, just all this money for DoD that doesn't have anything at, like, the program project activity level, wasn't sort of part of a budget request, and it's being handled by armed services instead of appropriations, and it's 5 year money. And, like, how do you even crosswalk this to what they're asking for? But the more important big picture thing is, like, what does this do to the annual appropriations process? If it is the case right now that Republicans are going to get a lot of extra defense money in their reconciliation bill, right? Does that shrink how much they're going to ask for on the appropriations side? Probably not. Probably not by a lot, right? And what is this money? Is this going to be scored as annual appropriations? I, probably not, right? And And so I don't even know how to think about this stuff. And even at like just a functional level, like who's going to handle sort of the crosswalk of this over to DOD? There must be people at DOD, Armed Services, and House Appropriations Defense and Senate Appropriation Defense who are just like, figuring this out, what this money is going to do, where it's going to go, how it's going to be counted.
It's really bizarre. I mean, like, Democrats did this in the Inflation Reduction Act, and as far as I can tell, that's the first time it was done, right? Where they just kind of stuck,
ARPA has,
like,
I think ARPA has a tiny bit of this stuff, but you're right.
oh, really?
IRA is where this really sort of takes
Yeah,
off.
they ratchet it up, and I mean, like, their Department of Commerce programs that are running off of money from that. It's like a lot of the like, same with the agriculture USDA. Like, they've got some stuff in there in terms of like infrastructure projects for farms and like clean energy projects and credits and all this other stuff. Like, those programs are being run by money that was pumped out through the reconciliation process, not the appropriations process. So it's really kind of weird. Like, do the appropriations committees have like a say over those programs? Do they have like, can they tweak them? Is there a way in which that they can they adjust the money that's available? I mean, like,
Does
theoretically,
reprogramming guidelines from House Appropriations matter in this money? It's very
yes.
strange.
It is really weird. And I kind of like, you can kind of see how it's like, oh, we're handling this in the reconciliation process. You don't need to worry about like getting an excessive amount of money for like defense or DHS or, for example. But it does, like, it certainly kind of kills a lot of the power and authority that appropriations has traditionally held.
I think it kills a lot of the power that Congress has, right? Like, what is the like is Armed Services set up to oversee this money? Like, who's doing the oversight of this, right? There is no budget proposal that sort of brought this on. Like, what are you following? What are like, what it, there's no project level tables like there would be in a normal purpose bill. It's very disturbing to me. And even more so, like what's next, right? What's next? Like, because it's like only like kind of insane to imagine an entire annual appropriations bill being stuffed in the reconciliation process. And then where are we, right? On and you pair this with the other thing that's going on, which is that the White House still hasn't sent over the actual budget. And they're writing these bills without sort of an actual budget materials from the administration. And it really feels like the wheels have fallen off. And then you combine that with the administration sort of like playing like a little bit of friendly games with impoundment and things like that, and you're really
That's not that friendly. That's not that
right.
friendly.
It's like, and they're not, it's like what's going on? But I'm
You know,
very concerned about the spending power right now and the reconciliation bills. I think we've talked a little bit about how if you do sort of rescissions by bare majority, like they're talking about doing in the Senate, that can blow up the ability to deal on annual appropriations because that's a super majority requirement because of the filibuster. But like, this is the same thing. If you're going to do what is all, for all intents and purposes, annual appropriations in a reconciliation bill, you're also blowing up the ability to carve out bipartisan deals on appropriations. So I really don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, I don't either. It's super concerning to see. And I don't know. I've been trying to find it. I haven't tried. That's a lie. I've been casually trying to look to see if the House is like deemed a number and the Senate have deemed a number. I don't know that they have. The appropriations committees are working as if they have a number. But it's interesting. I mean, you can almost feel the appropriations committees trying to be relevant in this particular political space at this moment, because the appropriation, the process is broken. They don't have a number, and they're just putting out bills, essentially, like saying, like, we're going to do this, we're going to do this, we're going to do the annual oversight of these programs. And the reality is, like, the leaders of both chambers are sort of like slow walking this. They're sort of like running interference on a lot of these bills and the appropriations process, simply because, like, I don't think they're interested in passing like annual appropriations right now. I think that it causes too much grief and too much friction with the White House, right? The White House wants to cut spending, and the fact is their members don't, right? I mean, Susan Collins doesn't want to cancel contracts at the University of Maine. Brian Fitzpatrick does not want to cancel NIH, right? I mean, a lot of these like impoundments and a lot of the canceled contracts, USDA, or sorry, USAID is having problems getting its rescission money approved in the Senate, and like, they're trying to put pressure on them, but like, I don't know that that's going to work. I think it's just that, like, unfortunately, this is like literally an institutional prerogative thing, and the party leaders of the chambers are running interference for Congress's power, right? Essentially.
The other thing that is worrying to me is that for the first time, I think in my life, I am concerned that the Democrats are going to feel a ton of pressure to cause a shutdown in September. And that's disconcerting because I don't care who's in the minority or who's in the majority. I don't like shutdowns. I don't like shutdown politics. I don't think they're winnable, and they're certainly not good for sort of the governance of the country and the execution of policy in the executive branch. And I'm double concerned because I think in this case, there's going to be a lot of pressure to do it, and I think it's going to backfire and only help sort of the administration. I don't mean the Trump administration, although that is the beneficiary here. I just mean sort of the executive branch going forward. I don't think these shutdowns caused by the minority party in Congress are good for Congress at all.
No, I don't think so either. I think on the other hand, like Democrats feel pressure to shut down the government because they've lost spending power, right? I mean,
Yeah,
the Congress
100%.
has ceded its core institutional authority. And I think that they feel pressure not just from like their party base to like oppose Trump in this way, but they also feel pressure like as an institutional actor, right? I mean, as like a constitutional force within the separation of powers to force them to spend money, right? I don't know how you do that. I don't know how you do that through law, to be honest with you, given in the current environment. But I think that they're going to feel pressure to do that. And I don't, and I think you're right. Like, I don't think that that's a provision that members of the Republican Party can sign off on, where it's like, yeah, we're cool with like forcing them to spend money that they're currently holding back or impounding. That's it's a very tricky situation. I don't know that there's going to be a deal on spending come September or December. Like, there's going to be a CR in September. That's fine. But honestly, if I was looking at the tea leaves and trying to figure out who's playing the best poker hand right here, or who's playing what poker hand, I think leaders are sort of thinking another year-long CR with administration just kind of like doing willy-nilly what they want with the appropriated funds is
It's not
probably the
great.
situation they're aiming for, would be my
Yeah, it's
guess.
not
Right? They
great.
did it once, they're trying to do it again. Right? And that's a depressing spot to be for somebody who wants Congress to be the center of the government, as it has
Sure.
been for 250 years.
So, one sort of notable thing, very small thing in appropriations, is CJS markup in the Senate yesterday. The administration announced that they were not going to sort of move the FBI headquarters out to Greenbelt, Maryland, as Congress had directed, but we're going to put it in the Reagan Building downtown, right? And Chris Van Hollen, for both sort of I think ideological reasons, but also for constituent reasons, was like, "Hell no, you're going to put it in Maryland, dude." And he forced an amendment in the markup to basically a limitation amendment saying, a limitation amendment is saying you can't use funds to do something, and saying no funds can be used to put the new FBI headquarters anywhere except in Maryland. And he got Murkowski to go for it. So that passed in the committee. And then they reported out the bill on a bipartisan basis. And so now sitting in the Senate is a CJS bill that is not going to allow the administration to put the FBI building in Washington. And this is sort of the small bore type of appropriation spending power battle. That is going to be adjudicated between obviously the House and Senate. I don't think the House is going to take that position. And then it's going to have to be a fight between Congress and Trump. And it's the kind of thing you can bury in an omnibus that the administration is not going to sort of veto the omnibus over this, if the omnibus ever happens, of course. And so that's the sort of thing where I think that it is sort of, we were saying, I feel like Congress is, waning in its power, but little things like that are helpful, and it's nice to see those sort of things pass. I'm a huge fan of limitation provisions in appropriations acts. It's the most effective use of the spending power, and I wish Congress would do more of it. The courts are not coming to Congress's rescue on the spending power. Congress has to do it itself. And if majorities in Congress don't want to do it, it's not going to happen. And if majorities in Congress do want to do it, but don't actually sort of start to play hardball, it's not going to happen. They could turn the administration around really quickly with one limitation amendment that restricted funding for the White House and EOP. And that's not coming on the horizon, but it's just sitting there waiting. This isn't a magic trick. You just turn off the money over at the EOP, the Executive Office of the President, and you get their attention real fast, and you'll get them to the bargaining table real fast. This current Congress does not have the will to do that currently. I don't even know if a future Congress will, but certainly not this one.
Yeah, I mean, I really do think you need a partisan turn, right? Switch in the majority in order for that to even come. And then even then, I don't know if I could envision Democrats doing it, to be quite frank.
You're right.
That's such a bold step. Like, I don't know that they would have that in them.
Yeah, no, I agree. But that to me is a for like using sort of a government shutdown to sort of adjudicate the spending power. It would be much preferable, in my view, for the Democrats, or if a Democrat had the White House, for the Republicans as a combined Congress, to have a unified Congress of the opposition party passing appropriations bills that had sort of very strong arm provisions about the spending authority, and then daring the president to veto them. That's the way to do it. And then once he vetoes them, just sticking to your guns and being like, well, this is the deal, or forcing them to eat them. Doing this from the minority party in Congress is a much tougher sledding. And of course, there's ramifications for the election too.
Yeah, it certainly does. All right, we've been talking for 44 minutes, I think. Nobody listens to podcasts that go out longer than 45 minutes. So, do you have any final thoughts?
I don't, except to say that thank God they got their concession bill done, because I was on the Hill the last 2 days, and it should be an Eighth Amendment violation to have to wear like pants in Washington in this weather. So congratulations to the House for being out right now. Congratulations to the Senate for going home for the weekend, and please stay cool as you try to sort of work the policy process in Washington in July. It's a nightmare.
Yeah, it's really hot here. We hope it's better weather where you are. That's it for us. We will hopefully have one and before the next 6 months arrives again or something along those lines. 5 months since we've done one. In any event, that's it. So we'll see you next time.
Thanks.